Our book reviewer, Alan Chews, has been reading a new novel about a family. It's called We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves. The book explores childhood, child rearing, sibling love and rivalry, profound if familiar topics. But one aspect of this family is highly unusual.
The Cooks of Bloomington, Indiana, are made up of Dad and Mom, along with their children Rosemary, her brother Lowell, and the youngest offspring in the house. She's named Fern. Together, they're engaged in a home life experiment under the auspices of a major American university's psychology department. The thing is, Fern, whom young Rosemary regards almost as a twin, is an African-born chimpanzee. When Fern gets untimely ripped from them, in part because of a nasty childish trick played by Rosemary, the family gets torn apart. Rosemary, our narrator, who's a 22-year-old college student as the novel opens, has tried throughout her adolescence to keep her monkey sister private. She's twisted her own story and life into a pretzel to avoid admitting what she takes to be odd and damaging news about herself and her background. As a result, she's not a happy person, distancing herself from friends and occasional lovers, longing to see her estranged brother Lowell again. Seems he's run off to join up with the Animal Liberation Front, and emotionally drained from her efforts to come to terms with family. All sorts of fascinating questions arise from her story. What is freedom? What is captivity? What is animal? And what is human? By the time you get to the last section of the novel, which is absolutely sublime, I have to tell you, you'll feel as though Rosemary and Fern are your own siblings, and you too may be, as I was, completely beside yourself, with a mixture of misery and joy.
Alan Chews reviewed We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves by Karen Joy Fowler. For more updates about books and authors, you can like NPR Books on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. That's at NPR Books.
This is NPR News.
Apple and Samsung have been locked in a war over technology patents for years now. And late today, Samsung won a major battle. The U.S. International Trade Commission issued a ruling that could keep some of Apple's older iPhones and iPads out of the American market. For more, we're joined by NPR technology correspondent Steve Henn. And Steve, last summer, Apple won a $1 billion jury verdict against Samsung after accusing the South Korean electronics firm of copying its designs. So what's today's development?
Well, today in Washington, D.C., Samsung won a major victory, as you said, when the International Trade Commission ruled that Apple infringed on a Samsung patent and issued this exclusion order that could ban some devices, including the iPhone 4, the 3GS, the iPad 3, the iPad 3G, and the iPad 2G from import into the U.S. market. The latest iPhones and iPads are unaffected. Now, this ban won't go into effect immediately, and President Obama actually has 60 days to veto it, or Apple can appeal the ruling in federal court. Finally, Apple could just, you know, say uncle and agree to license this technology from Samsung and pay to use it.
So what does this patent the ITC says Apple infringed cover exactly?
Well, the International Trade Commission found that Apple was infringing on a patent by Samsung that covers data transmission on all of these devices. But what was really interesting about this patent is that it's what's known in the industry as a standard essential patent. And that means that it covers a technology that every player in the wireless industry needs to be able to make the system as a whole work for these devices to talk to the network and to talk to each other. So when a company is granted a standard essential patent, one of the things that has to happen is it agrees that it will license this technology on fair and reasonable terms to everyone.
So how did the patent become the subject of this lawsuit at the International Trade Commission?
Well, basically, this became a lawsuit when Samsung and Apple couldn't agree on what those words, fair and reasonable, mean. Apple says Samsung demanded a 2.4% cut of every iPhone and iPad it sold that used the technology. That would come to something in the neighborhood of like $10 a gadget. Manufacturers like Apple typically prefer to pay a percentage of the cost of just the chip that uses the technology. And in that case, or in this case, that would just be a few cents. So Samsung has been arguing that it has offered Apple fair and reasonable licensing terms for these technologies for years. And today, at least on this one patent, the ITC agreed.
One last thing, Steve. Why is the International Trade Commission hearing cases on patents?
Well, that's a great question. And actually, I had the same one. I mean, when you think of the International Trade Commission, if you think of it at all, you probably think of it in terms of hearing anti-dumping cases. But it turns out the ITC has been hearing patent disputes for years, and it's become a really popular venue for these cases. Because if the ITC finds that there's a patent violation and that there's commercial harm being caused by that violation, it can issue an injunction and stop a high-tech product from being imported into the U.S. In fact, just a few hours before this case came out, President Obama spoke about patent lawsuit abuses and asked for a review of the ITC. But the thing about patent fights is that they're waged all over the world, and right now a decision by the ITC gives the victor a lot of leverage.
That's NPR technology correspondent Steve Henn. Steve, thank you.
My pleasure.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
The president of one of the biggest universities in the country, Ohio State, has announced his retirement. This comes a week after a recording surfaced of unfortunate comments about Catholics and Southerners. Karen Kassler of Ohio Public Radio in Columbus reports.
Gordon Gee isn't your typical college president. The 69-year-old divorced Mormon is one of the highest-paid college presidents in the country and is thought to have led more universities than any other person in the U.S. With his distinctive round-rimmed glasses and ever-present bow tie, he's a fixture at Ohio State, the rare administrator who's so well-known, students actually seek out his autograph. He pops up at football games and graduation parties, and even joined a flash mob at the student union. The YouTube video has been seen nearly 5 million times. And Gee is a prolific fundraiser, having headed campaigns that raised billions of dollars in his two terms as president. He led Ohio State from 1990 to 1997, and he returned in 2007 after stints in charge at Brown and Vanderbilt. But there's another side to Gordon Gee, the gaffe maker. He's had several high-profile foot-and-mouth moments in the last few years. The latest was at an OSU Athletic Council meeting in December, not long after the football Buckeyes finished an undefeated season but could not compete for the national championship because of NCAA violations. A recording of Gee's remarks was obtained just last week by the Associated Press. And on it, Gee is heard talking about negotiating with Notre Dame officials about joining the Big Ten Conference.
First of all, they're not very good partners. I'll just say that. I negotiated with them during my first term, and the fathers are holy on Sunday, and they're holy hell on the rest of the week. You just can't trust those damn Catholics on a Thursday or Friday.
Same meeting, Gee also made remarks about the Southeastern Athletic Conference and specifically the University of Louisville.
Well, you tell the SEC when they can learn to read and write, then they can figure out what we're doing.
Those comments brought a harsh rebuke from the coach of the reigning NCAA Division I basketball champs, Rick Pitino, who blasted Guy on WHAS, a commercial radio station in Louisville.
I have a major problem with him, not with Ohio State. I have a major problem with him, and he's a pompous for making those statements.
Guy has said the remarks were a poor attempt at humor. University trustees called them unacceptable and put him on what was termed a remediation plan. Students at Ohio State had mixed reactions about Guy's retirement announcement. Alden Jones is a senior in accounting from Chicago.
It's on everybody's bucket list to have a picture with Guy, so it's a sad note to see him go.
Senior Allison Wright from Cincinnati is an urban planning major.
I think it's kind of embarrassing to go out on that note.
But Guy's work at the five universities he's headed has earned him fans in higher education. Scott Cowan is the president of Tulane University and chairs the Association of American Universities.
Regardless of how this ended, what I would hate to do is to have people lose sight, though, of, you know, how effective he has been for so long as a university president. That would be a shame.
Guy's retirement announcement doesn't mention the recent comments, but Guy says he made the decision to step down while on vacation with his family. For NPR News, I'm Karen Kassler in Columbus.
NPR's Uri Berliner has been trying to figure out what to do with some of his savings. The money in his bank account is losing value to inflation, something many of us are familiar with. So for our series Dollar for Dollar, Uri has taken $5,000 of his own and is putting it to work exploring different types of investments. Today, the stock market offers an unexpected lesson in psychology.
Deciding how to invest in the stock market can be kind of daunting. That's why I called on someone who's seen it all.
My name is Charlie Ellis, and I've had 50 years of experience in investment management from virtually every perspective.
Ellis founded Greenwich Associates, a research and consulting firm, and wrote an influential investing book called Winning the Loser's Game. His advice? Don't fear being boring. Embrace boring if you can. Passive, it's better than active.
Most of the people who are trying harder are actually hurting themselves.
When Americans invest in the stock market, it's usually through mutual funds. There are two varieties: actively traded funds, where an investment manager and his team try to pick winning stocks, and index funds that passively mimic a benchmark, like the S&P 500. Charlie Ellis says those actively traded funds, they're a bad bet.
Candidly, the data is very disturbing. More than half, comfortably more than half, over any reasonable 12-month period, fall short of the target they chose for themselves. And if you say, well, a year is too little, you really ought to extend it. Make it 10 years, it rises from about 60% fall short over 1 year to about 70% fall short over 10 years. And while the data gets pretty thin by the time you get it out to 20 years, it gets even worse. It goes up somewhere around 80% fall short.
For Ellis, this is a crucial point. A significant majority of funds that rely on managers to make trades do worse than passive index funds. And those active funds that happen to shine for a few years, you can't be sure they'll do it again in the future. The Warren Buffetts of the world are rare, and I'm not one of them. That's why Charlie Ellis is telling me, don't try to beat the market.
Well, it's not that you can't, it's that you won't.
The odds, he says, are stacked against me. The stacking comes from something called the expense ratio. It's the annual fee the fund charges you for the manager's salary and various administrative costs.
People pay way too much attention to past returns and way too little attention to the fees.
That's Terrence O'Dean, a finance professor at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. While fees for actively managed funds have been coming down, they still charge almost 1% a year on average. Average fees for index funds are much more modest, just over 0.1%. Over the long haul in a retirement account, those higher fees can cost an investor tens of thousands of dollars.
One thing about fees is high fees this year almost always means high fees next year. In fact, you know what your fees are going to be next year. But high performance this year doesn't really tell you too much about next year's performance.
So that must mean most investors seek out lower cost index funds to avoid those fees. Actually, they don't. There's more than six times as much money invested in actively managed funds, some $9.8 trillion, according to the Investment Company Institute. I wanted to find out why those numbers are lopsided in favor of higher cost funds. Brian Smith speaks on behalf of the mutual fund industry for the trade group MFEA. When I asked him to make the case for actively managed funds, he said they give investors a chance to beat the market.
People want to build wealth over time. They want to build their futures. And to do that, you need to have a diversified plan, which is across a spectrum of different areas of the investing marketplace. And there's where an active manager can make a big difference.
Charlie Ellis says that may be true, but probably not. He says instead, many investors are tempted by company marketing and media coverage that focuses on hot streaks.
And so you have the feeling that, oh, come on, people are winning. It looks sensible to win. In every other part of my life, I've always played to win. That must be one of the things that can be done here. Let me get the right fund or the right manager, and I'm going to be a winner.
Finally, and this is where the psychology comes in, lots of people who study financial behavior say we're just too confident in our ability to spot good investments.
Life feels better to the extent that you have this belief that things are going to be better than reality suggests.
Max Bazerman is a Harvard professor who studies business psychology. He calls this overconfident frame of mind motivated bias, and he says it can be helpful in pushing us to reach a goal, say in sports, or landing a new job, or even fighting an illness.
Positive illusions may be fine for helping us cope. They may be fine for motivating us, but we don't want to have those positive illusions when we're at the moment of decision.
Now I'm at that moment of decision, ready to pull the trigger on my investment in the stock market, and despite everything I've heard, I still have a real temptation to want to beat the market. So can you talk me out of it?
I don't know if I can talk you out of it. I'd be happy to try.
Bazerman is pretty blunt. What makes me think I'll be on the right side of a trade and not the wrong one? What makes me think I can pick the right fund manager? Is there any reason whatsoever for thinking I would have a competitive advantage?
So I would ask you to think about, why do you think that you can outperform the market? Realizing that if you pay an extra percent a year on your investments over the next 20 years, you're giving up 20%.
That's a ballpark estimate, but over the years, it still adds up to a huge amount going to fees. It's so big that when I finally decide to buy, I look for someone who knows how to find a bargain. Miranda Marquette is a personal finance blogger. She developed a grudge against high fees after winding up in some expensive funds when she was younger.
The very top fund on the list is the U.S. Large Cap ETF. And this has an expense ratio of 0.04%. So that's low.
We're shopping online together for exchange-traded funds, or ETFs. They're similar to mutual funds.
Next, they've got the U.S. Broad Market ETF. So that's also a very low expense ratio, and it includes everything in the U.S. market.
For some geographical balance, we're also checking out an international fund.
Yeah, that one would be a good one. So you can get most of the total world stocks. It's a pretty low expense ratio, and it'll expose you to everything in the world.
In the end, I spend $749 on a broad U.S. stock fund, $652 on a global fund, and $577 on a stock fund that pays out regular dividends. I've got diversification in stocks, and the fees are low. It's a boring portfolio, really boring. But that's the point. I'll have to find my thrills elsewhere. Rory Berliner, NPR News.
In golf, the St. Jude Classic is underway in Memphis. For the big-name players taking part in the charity tournament, it is the last stop before the U.S. Open. Commentator Frank DeFord says he'll be doing the difficult double act of paying attention to the action on the course while rolling his eyes.
When my old pal, the sports curmudgeon, had some mildly churlish things to say about golf a few weeks ago, both he and I were upbraided by loyal linksters. As one snapped at me, "You don't know anything about golf." Perhaps, but I do know all about golf propaganda. Because major golf tournaments continue to maintain a 19th-century pose and require golfers to keep their own score, instead of having a paid scorekeeper and a 21st-century electronic device to tally the number of shots, as is the case in every other big-time sport, golf loves to pretend that this somehow makes the sport more noble. The tiresome network shills can never stop boasting about how golf is a more honorable game than all the others. But really, it's just silly. Is there anything more archaic than after a round which is dragged on for several hours, every shot dutifully recorded on TV, the golfers must repair to some secret rendezvous where I believe there is an abacus to make sure that everybody can count to 71. Then they sign their scorecards like they were the Declaration of Independence. Imagine! Sign here, Mr. LeBron James, to certify that you really did make the 36 points that we all saw you score on network television. Now, to start with, the primary contention that it is golfers alone who keep their own score is itself a shibboleth. Go to any club or public park, watch the tennis players, the handball players, the guys playing basketball. They all keep their own score, just like golfers. And for that matter, you don't think it's more ethically challenging calling a cross-court shot that your tennis opponent slugged into the corner than it is hitting your own stationary ball sitting there still on a tee? The only difference between golf and every other sport is that golf alone ludicrously persists in having its professionals play by the same antiquated rules as weekend duffers. Oh, I've got a good idea. Let's get rid of linesmen and have Novak Djokovic and Andy Murray keep their own score at Wimbledon to prove how honorable they are. Look, golf may be a fine game, but nothing is more irritating than to hear this con that its players are pure and chivalrous, while all other athletes are immoral scoundrels. Cut the PR falderall. I guarantee you that Diogenes didn't put away his lantern when he first stumbled onto a golf course.
Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday from WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. His latest book, Overtime, My Life as a Sports Writer, is now out in paperback. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montagne.